Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs. Here are your hosts, Julie Fudge-Smith and Colleen Pilar.
By Dr. Tricia McConnell. She was on a previous episode where we talked about fear and trauma, and that was a really good episode, and we delve into a lot of really tough, heavy subjects. And we decided we wanted to have a little more fun because Dr. McConnell, if you don't know, is, to use Julie's term, the Arnold Schwarzenegger of the dog world. She's got a PhD in zoology. She's been doing animal behavior and improving relationships between people and dogs for more than 25 years. And she's written many, many, many wonderful books, the most recent of which to be released is a paperback edition of The Education of Will. So thanks so much for joining us today, Tricia.
You know, I get compared to Arnold Schwarzenegger daily.
Daily.
actually not. Julie, that's actually the first time. I don't know what to say, but I'm going to take that as a great compliment, and I will tell that to my Pilates trainer tomorrow.
Well, I was talking to my fitness trainer and trying to come up with a, you know, she's looking at me, and I'm like, it's like, if Arnold Schwarzenegger came, you know, and I said, she's the Arnold Schwarzenegger of the dog training world. Really, seriously, this is so cool. So we're very excited to have you here, and I'll try really hard not to call you.
Thank you.
So one of the things is that people tend, when I say I'm a dog trainer, I don't know if you find this, say, oh, that must be so much fun, and what a great, happy life. And I'm like, yeah, you know, if you want to smell like liver for a good part of the day, it's the job for you. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts came to mind about the glamour aspect of dog training that you've experienced.
Oh yeah. You know, my description is that I think people envision us spending our days running through fields of daisies with golden retriever puppies.
Yes.
Right? That, you know, that's mm-hmm. what we do. And it's sort of one big oxytocin-hazed, you know, scene with music playing in the background. And, you know, and the fact of the matter is, it's not. And it's not that it's not just not glamorous. I mean, you know, liver stinky liver pockets and dog poop and, you know, yeah, mm-hmm. there's all that.
There's yeah. all that.
But there's also, you know, and I know this happens to you too, and it happens to every trainer, and it happens, I think, especially to behaviors who specialize in aggression, as I did, is I was prepared for danger. I was prepared for the fact that I'd be working with dogs who bit people and that I was physically going to be in a small room with dogs who were dangerous. I was mostly prepared for that, and it didn't put me off. What I was not prepared for was the emotional pain and agony that would happen in my office on an almost daily basis.
Right.
People whose dogs,
yes.
I know you guys, family dog, I know you deal with this. It's like people who are fighting because the dog bit their mm-hmm. 5-year-old son and he wants, you know, or she wants the dogs put down, and the partner or spouse wants the dog rehabilitated and worked with. And just, you know, the amount, we love them so much, and that makes mm-hmm. us so vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's not just not glamorous, but it's also really emotionally very hard. I would go home just exhausted, you know, just really mm-hmm. tiring. Now, even on my blog, The Other End of the Leash, I've written a couple of blog pieces in years past about when is the time to put a dog down for a behavioral problem. They've had hundreds and hundreds of comments, and I approve comments every day. And so often I read these heartbreaking stories of people who have to decide about whether to put a dog down for severely aggressive behavior and the trauma they've gone through. So because we love them so much, you know, it means that there's a lot of pain and heartache. So wasn't this supposed to be the happy, funny?
This was supposed to be the
I am so sorry. But so, that is an answer to your question, is we are not always running through fields of daisies with golden retriever puppies. So I have a story that has that is actually a story on me. It really relates to a sheep herding demo. This is years ago. My friend, partner, colleague, Nancy Raffetto, and I, we came from the same lab at the same department at the University of Wisconsin, and she had retrievers, and I had sheepdogs. So we would do this really fun demo on genetics and sort of versus training. And we were doing it at a big outdoor Scottish festival outside of Milwaukee. And it was a really fun demo in that I would bring my sheep, and then the short version is that at one point we would throw a ball into the middle of the sheep, and her dog would bust into the sheep, totally ignore the sheep, take the ball, bring it back to her, and I sent the border collie, who would round the sheep up and bring them back to me. And it was really a really incredibly fun demo. However, it did not go well this time, because the sheep are out in this field, big, huge, maybe probably two-acre field. And in the back of the field was a really, really thick 6-foot hedge. I mean, it was basically a fence. It was like a solid green wall. And I'm about to send Willie, or Luke, actually, to do some sheep herding demo stuff. And behind us, a band strikes up. So, one, Willie can't hear me signaling him anymore, because he's 100 yards away from me. The sheep panic and take off. And they start running towards the back of the field. But, you know, there's like a fence there, right? So I'm not totally worried, but trying to send Willie. And Willie's, or Luke, and Luke is sort of looking at me like, what? And, you know, the noise is bothering him too. And so the sheep get to the hedge fence, except they disappear inside of it. It's like an Alice in Wonderland moment where they literally just go through the hedge fence and disappear. And so Nancy is on the microphone, and so she's talking to this crowd of, like, you know, 200 people, 200-300 people, and I run 200 yards across the field, and I find a little hole in this hedge fence, and I crawl through, and literally, like Alice in Wonderland, I am in a suburb. I mean, I've been in this sort of big area with fields and open ground, and I'm now in a suburb.
And how many sheep have we lost here in the suburb?
And so they're like, you know, they're 5 sheep, right? And so I'm like looking down the streets and the sidewalks and the porches and, you know, the beautiful houses. And I finally see my sheep about a block away on somebody's porch, literally. So me and Luke go get the sheep, and I'm like terrified and panicked, like my heart is beating out of my chest. So Luke and I get the sheep back towards the hedge, where of course they don't want to go because, you know, now they're not terrified anymore, and it's a hedge fence, right? Why would they go through that, right? So I'm trying to get them through the hedge fence, and they go, there's a house right next door, and they run into the garage. So they're now in somebody's, I'm not making this up, they're in somebody's garage. And so I'm like, okay, this is great. So panicking, me and Luke go in to push them out of the garage, and we sort of knock some stuff over, and there's this noise, and then amazingly, I get the sheep out of the garage, and right before I did get them to push through the fence to go back into the field, I literally hear, Edith, there's sheep in the garage. and as I'm going through the fence, I hear, oh, Harvey. And we get back into the field. There's nobody there. It's been like 20 minutes, right? There's nobody there. Nancy's sort of sitting in the car going like, well, you know, I talked for as long as I could. So there you are. There's my finest demonstration experience.
And I'm feeling sorry for Harvey, because now there were no sheep in the garage. And so she's like, gosh, he's always making up these stories.
Edith is never going to believe Harvey again.
No,
that's very
poor Harvey.
Actually, poor Harvey. Edith, there's sheep in the.
Well,
that's
so
hysterical.
The question is, did she say on the microphone? So the lesson of this is that you should have a golden retriever, because presumably her dog got the ball and came back.
Oh, I never. You know, yeah, we just drove back feeling like, you know, pretty much idiots. Strangely, we weren't asked to come back the next year.
Really? I find that surprising. I would have thought there would have been, you know, comedy fest.
I know. All over us, right? Now, that's right. I'm sure you guys have a story on your, you know, your watch that you did something that maybe didn't quite go as you planned.
where do I begin is more like it. The thing that's always a favorite for me is one thing I refuse to do is take my dog to class and use my dog as a demo dog. I will use the dogs in class as a demo dog. And that's got amount of uncertainty to it. And I remember one beginning class I was trying to teach down. I mean, which is, you know, pretty easy, basic thing. I had five dogs. I couldn't get a single one to lay down. And I'm like, really? This works. You just got to try it at home. I'm luring forwards. I'm luring backwards. We're doing. Everybody's doing play bows. They're getting up. They're going here. I couldn't even get the little ones to lure them underneath my leg, you know, and have them lay down. And I was like, that's it. I'm just going to resign. Five dogs. I couldn't get a single one to lay down. It's not happened to me either before or since. I can at least usually get one dog to lay down. But no, they're all like, it's like they'd all talk to each other before class.
Yeah, a little passive resistance.
Yes. So yeah, that was, and the owners are all like, we're paying how much for this? That comes to mind.
I have a down story. When I started training, I was 25 years old and extremely shy and did no public speaking whatsoever, but I totally loved dogs. So it was worth it to me to get over my tremendous crippling fear to talk to people about dogs. So I had this okay, and now we're going to do this, you know, whatever the class was. And I was all nervous. And so in my second set of 8 classes, so I've been a dog trainer now for, you know, a few months, I'm trying to get a St. Bernard to lie down. And I was teaching in a county park, and it's spring in Virginia, which means it's muddy. So I'm trying to get the St. Bernard to lie down, and I'm trying to lure him down, and I lose my balance and start to slide, and I wind up splatting completely on my back, lying in the mud, with the St. Bernard standing over me, looking curiously down at me, like, what happened here? And it was humiliating. Like, could you please just suck me into the earth, and I could die right now. That would be okay. But I had to get up, covered in mud, and keep teaching class. And it was actually a really good pivotal moment for me, because I was like, you know what? It's okay.
Live through that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. The people Nothing didn't happened. All take their dogs and go home. They didn't all, you know, but it was so embarrassing and of course wet and uncomfortable and icky.
Yes. And they probably, but you know, it probably actually from their perspective, even though they were sympathetic, but you know, a lot of times things like that can sort of break the ice. And
yeah.
And I think, mm-hmm. I think I've heard a lot of, I mean, how many times have you heard dog owners say, oh, you mean that happens to you too?
Yeah.
Or you mean you've made that mistake too? It's mm-hmm. like, you know, dog trainers, the best dog trainer, the best animal trainer in the world still messes up. You know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it's such a relief, I think, for some dog owners to be like, you know, your dog does that? It's like, yep.
Yep.
Yep, they do.
They sure do.
Expect your dogs to be. People apologize to you all the time. And I'm always going to I'm so sorry, you know, he's not well behaved. I'm like, he doesn't have his teeth in my thigh. I don't care if he's peeing on my leg, but he doesn't have his teeth in my thigh. So anything else is great. You know, if your dog is overly friendly and he's jumping up, yay-hoo for that. If you don't want him to do it, I'll teach you how not to, but I don't care.
Yeah.
Right. And people are like, because we talked about that, I think, in a past podcast, is that there's this part of me that's like, I get that you don't want the dog to do this, but yay, you have a social dog. And it's...
have a friendly dog.
Yeah. And that's key. So what I find too is that when I'm doing a lot of behavior consults, and most of the stuff that comes across my desk is aggressive behavior modification that people want, you know, my dog, you know, bit the neighbor, or my dog did this, or my dog's reactive on leash. And, you know, I will take those cases, but I got to tell you, every once in a while, when you get that dog that's just a puppy and it's a great dog and just needs some training, how much more I enjoy having the non-difficult dog, that it some ways that I love working with the dogs that are difficult, because so many people are like, I don't know what to do. And if I can make a change in their life and help them to have a dog that can function in society, I'm happy to do that. But it does become so joyful for me to have a client that doesn't have a serious problem. Mm-hmm. And that's really fun. But this also helps me keep perspective too, because after a while you begin to think that it's normal for dogs to, you know, have these difficult, fearful or aggressive moments. And it's always good to be reminded that it doesn't have to be that way, or what the objective is that you would prefer to have in your dog.
Oh, I think that's such a good point. You know, I think there's a phenomenon that's almost universal among people who specialize in serious behavioral problems, is we get more and more thoughtful, and you could even say cautious, about greeting dogs we don't know, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so, you know, we would sort of never all, it doesn't take very long, you would never barrel up to a dog you've never met.
No.
Right?
No.
You know? But people who don't have our experience, so we sort of end up becoming more cautious, you know, mm-hmm. because you know what can happen if you're not, right? Because you sort of see mm-hmm. it all the time, and, you know, so I've been amused. I've been with friends who are like, oh, look at that sweet dog, and they sort of run over there, and the dog is fine. The dog's like, yay, do whatever you want, I'm okay.
And part of me is just holding my breath.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, ah. It's true. Well, I have a story I think is funny anyway. Obviously, the proof is in the pudding here. You guys can decide. But this is from my radio show. I did a radio show with Larry Mueller on Wisconsin Public Radio called Calling All Pets for 15 years or so. And so people often ask me, like, who was your favorite caller? And so I don't know. I don't know why I was thinking about this just yesterday, but I was. So people could call in with questions about behavior, and it wasn't just dogs and cats. It was any animal at all, which made it really extra fun. So this guy calls me from Georgia, and he loves to feed birds, and he has a big, huge bird feeder that's hanging in a pine tree. And it gets raided by a black bear. So the black, which is really common, bears love birdseed. So this black bear is like, you know, swiping down this bird feeder and eating all the seed. And the guy didn't want it to happen anymore. So his question was, he said, if I get a ladder and put it against the tree and then urinate on the tree really high up, will that make him think I'm a big, huge mammal and he'll stay away from the tree? And after a moment of stunned silence, I said, I'll tell you what, send me a video. and I'll send it to an expert in bear behavior, one of my colleagues. But I just, this image of this guy crawling up a ladder and then mm-hmm. urinating on his tree, it's never left me.
No.
Sometimes you just can't unsee things, you know?
Indeed. Right.
Even things you haven't actually seen, you can't unsee.
Even things you haven't actually
Yeah, our brains are so good at creating images to go with words.
Wow.
We fill in the details.
I have not had that question, but that's a good one.
Well, someday you might.
I might.
Now you're ready, right?
So did he send, did he send you the video?
I never got, no, he didn't.
Oh, too bad.
Nope.
So.
But I did talk to a expert in bears. Oh, I can't remember his name. I'm so sorry. Dr. X. I talked to Dr. X here at University of Wisconsin, and sort of jokingly told him that. And he said, nah, sorry. I don't think it's going to help any.
Well, for one thing, I think urine between species is just not nearly as effective as urine in any given species. So
within species, yes.
Yeah.
Good. And good for all of us to remember.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So often thinking of all of the examples of, you know, that surely that makes sense in our dominance theories.
Although yes. I will, that actually makes me think of something that is important. When One of my dogs is Maggie. She's a now 5-year-old border collie. We got her when she was 14 months old. And she was one of those dogs who, she basically needed to learn to pee on cue. And so we're at a place we'd never been before, a friend's cabin in the woods, and we wanted to get unpacked and get inside, but I wanted her, for obvious reasons, to pee before we went inside. Obvious reasons, right? Well, and she just, she wouldn't. She's just so, she was just so into her nose and trying, you know, she was just too nervous, as I'm guessing. I'm certainly overwhelmed by sort of all these, this, you know, this new sensory experience. And so I said, Jim, help me out here. So Jim, a guy, right? So he goes over, right? Yeah, you got it. So Jim goes over, pees next to a tree, right? Maggie comes over, pees right on it.
Good for Maggie.
And good for Jim.
Yes.
So a couple of, while Maggie was in this sort of learning process, you know, as she was adapting to a new life with us, you know, we'd get out of the car and I just sort of looked, you know, at first it was like, Jim, would you? And then it was just Jim. And then it was just like, I just look at him. I'm happy to say that Maggie no longer needs a prompt.
That's so good.
But yeah.
Yeah. But, it's kind of like, it's like that the lure reward system, you know, that's the lure for him, for her.
Yeah.
So now you can just go to a strict reward-based system.
So. Yeah, and so nice that Jim was willing to help, because it would be a lot more awkward if you had to do it.
This is a... No kidding. this is definitely a good guy. This is a good husband to keep.
Although, I do have a somewhat similar story that also happened this weekend. I had a friend come out for part of the weekend, and we walked around the lake, and we got to a point, and I needed to use the facilities, and there were none, except there were woods. So I dropped the leash on the Bernese Mountain Dog and went over and did my duty. And as I was walking away, who should go over but sniff at it and lift his leg. It can work the other way as well. Just FYI. So
yes, even between species, it's still relevant.
Well, yes. I guess now we have to go back and say maybe your bear advice wasn't as good as we think, because maybe he really should have gotten the ladder.
Maybe he should have gotten the ladder. Yeah. Well, anybody
seems to work for dogs.
If you have a bear eating your bird seed, we are asking for a video and for results.
Well, the other thing is, I wonder, is it urine? Okay, I still am not convinced that urine between species is generally as much of a prompt as perhaps it was in these two particular instances. Could it have been because we were familiar to these dogs that this urine became of interest?
You know, that actually raises a really interesting question. I'm working on a talk that I'm going to give in Mexico City. If I can call it up here right now really quickly, I can tell you the name of the researcher, but here's the research that you are reminding me of. A researcher looked at where dogs, so imagine a dog being approached by a person. The person could be familiar or the person could be unfamiliar, okay? Mm-hmm. And so they basically mapped where dogs sniff, people who are familiar and unfamiliar. And so it is Filiatre who did this research in 1981. And so basically, the people who are familiar get sniffed all over their feet, which is like, where have you been? Right? Mm-hmm. It took me a while to figure out why Maggie was sniffing down the driveway. She's sniffing the tires.
Mm-hmm.
What information have you brought in on the tires? So they sniff the feet of unfamiliar people and legs and lots and lots and lots around the hands and arms. Unfamiliar people, almost nothing on the feet, and a ton of concentration on the crotch.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
So, yeah. And just like dogs sniff unfamiliar dogs. So I think they can get a lot of information from urine, even from other species, especially species that they consider to be part of their social system.
Mm-hmm.
So there you are. You know, science comes to the rescue yet again.
That's interesting. One interesting sniffing thing at my house is I currently have only one dog. And when I come back, I get different inspections. So ordinary go to the grocery store inspection is, oh, hi, you're home. Dog class inspection is sort of the sniffing of the feet and the hands. Yeah. But a dog that had issues, any dog that had me going, oh, be careful, I get what we call the full inspection. Like there is sniffing and nudging and who have you been near? And it's really interesting.
That is interesting because what I'm wondering is two things. And the full inspection, is he picking up your pheromones? Pheromones? And two, is he picking up the stress pheromones of the other dog? Because in general, you know, and who knows? I mean, it depends a little bit on usually if I'm dealing with aggressive dogs, I'm not doing a lot of cuddling. You know, I'm not touching the dog nearly as much. So that makes me wonder if my dog is picking up on my own stress hormones. Mm-hmm. And pheromones that I'm releasing. And
that's
wondering,
a great question.
Yeah, and Enzo won't tell me. I've asked him.
He won't tell you. Well, there's a research project just waiting to happen, right? You
know, it has been interesting, too. There have been a couple of dogs where I in the appointment have had mixed feelings where I'm like, well, I don't know. I mean, I think he's like on the edge. He's maybe not that bad. And then I come home and I get the inspection and I'm like, oh. Yo, thank you, Enzo. I am no longer on the fence.
That's very interesting. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, and I find in some ways those are the clients. People say, well, you know, it's such a happy job. I'm like, yeah, you sit and counsel somebody about their aggressive dog and lay out the options that you see are available. You know, this dog has bitten multiple times and fights with the other dog in the household, and they're talking about rehoming. I'm like, who? Who's going to take this dog? Those are tough.
Situation.
But the other ones that are tough are the ones that Colleen was just saying that you just don't know, that are on that cusp. Is this a dog that has serious, are we heading towards really serious problems? Can we rein it back? You know, those in some ways are the hardest ones that I'm less sort of convinced that this is either something we can manage or something that is beyond the scope of what most people can do. So there's some tough aspects to being a trainer to try and guide these people into, you know, making a decision that's right for them. And I learned from a vet at the Midwestern Veterinary Conference a couple years ago, I've got this in mind, is he said, you cannot be the ones to tell somebody if they need to put their dog down or not. You can give them your counsel, but there may be a reason why they're not going to put that dog down that you don't know about. And it was shortly after that I was working with a woman who had a very aggressive dog. And I just wasn't sure what we were going to do. And her brother had some special needs. And she said, I can't put this dog down because my brother relates to this dog. This dog has special needs and nobody understands him, just like he has special needs and nobody understands him. Mm-hmm. And if I put this dog down, it would be the same thing as saying to my brother, you're not worth working on either. And I was so grateful for that telling me you can't make this decision for other people. Because
I think that's just should be standard in the industry. I mean, it is not our dog, and it's not, you know, it's not appropriate for anybody in any kind of advice related profession to say this is what you should do. It's just not, you know, and I certainly will develop my own opinion. But I always talk to people about the three alternatives. You know, you have at least three alternatives. One is to, you know, do behavior mod, do management. You know, one is to rehome the dog, and one is to euthanize the dog. And it's never our decision. So I think, you know, yay for the vet for saying that, yay for you for picking up on it, because it's absolutely critical. It's simply not our decision. It's, you know, it's not professional to pretend that it is. So good for you.
Yeah.
And are we circling back to Gold Retriever puppies and Fields
I
of Daisy?
I hope so.
I think so.
I was thinking we might need to wrap up with what we like best about working with families and dogs, because we may have just scared all of our listeners away.
You know what I love best? I love best is the fact that in some ways what we have is a quiet little profession that makes a huge difference in the life of a person and an animal and a family. That if you have a dog that has a problem or it needs some training or whatever, that can be all encompassing of your life. And if you're committed to keeping that dog for the duration, then the fact that we can go in and give you some skills and some tools to make that duration happy, to me, that's huge. And it seems very tiny, but it's not, because I'm making a difference in the happiness of an animal and a family for perhaps as long as 10 years. And so, yeah, I'm not changing the world, but I may be changing one dog and one family at a time. And to me, that's why I stay with it. And that's the real joy of it all.
Well, that's just beautiful. And it's so true. Is, you know, I talk to trainers a lot about, there may not be a lot of social status in being a dog trainer, or you know, even frankly, a PhD animal behaviorist. But the fact of the matter is, what we do is really, really, really important, because it has a profound effect on health and safety and longevity. So here to everything you said. What I would add is that one of the things that fuels me, that is really important to me, is being aware and appreciating and understanding the connection that we as humans have with all the rest of nature. That, you know, mm-hmm. And my belief is that we are not sort of these separate. There's not this category of nature and then humans. You know, is that we are very much a part mm-hmm. of it, and losing, as we have, much of that feeling of connection has been, there have been all kinds of amazingly wonderful things that have come from it, the fact that we are special. But, you know, being special also means that you're different and you're alone. And I think what dogs do is they create this connection for us. You know, we may be special, but we're not alone. They are a bridge to the rest of the natural world to us that's so important. And I think keeping that bridge, whether wherever you live, whether it's in the country or in an apartment in New York City, I think dogs as a bridge to the rest of the natural world, I think is profoundly important and meaningful in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Very well said. Thank you. I feel very much the same way too. And that's kind of thing Colleen and I have touched on before, but you said it far more eloquently than I think we probably
I think the
did.
Two of you sound like a pair of philosophers, and I just like roll along just doing my dog training stuff.
Oh, Garden, you're just a
yeah.
lawyer.
But I think it's really true. And yeah, what both of yeah. you said really resonates with why we have animals in our lives, and why it matters so much to us that we have good relationships with them, and that they themselves are happy, that we want our mm-hmm. pets to be happy. And that matters deeply to us for all of the reasons mm-hmm. you said of the connection and the community aspects of it.
We so. Should have a National Trainers Appreciation Day.
We should.
Here we are. Let's decide that's today.
Today. Okay, so all we will right. be celebrating it again next January. I don't know when this episode will be released, but January 31st is National Dog Trainer Appreciation Day. Trish McConnell declared it so, and I'm posting it on Facebook when we get off the phone.
Here we are. Go buy some chocolate.
That's yes. right. One for me, one for Zuzu. So yeah, that's great. I like the National Dog Trainer Appreciation Day. You know, maybe if we're lucky, we can work it into a week, and then it can become a month. And
there
you
go.
All right. Well, Trisha, thank you so much for joining us. Loved your stories. Your books are terrific. I recommend any and all of your books. For our listeners, just pick one up and start reading. It doesn't matter in some ways which one you pick up. They're all terrific. Her most current one, of course, is The Education of Will, which has just recently come out in paperback, and is a wonderfully connected book and well written, and I really enjoyed all of them. So thank you so much for writing.
Thank you. And thanks for having me. It's been great fun. It's always fun to talk to you, too. I always learn something, and I always have a good time. So thanks for asking
me. Well,
great.
Thank you. All right.
We're so glad you could come.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Colleen and Julie would love to hear them. Call 614-349-1661 or visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.